Support for Commodity Week comes from the Friends of WILL and from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign. With crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
This is the August 16 edition of Commodity Week. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our panelists today include Dale Durkles of AgriVisor out of Bloomington, Illinois, Jim McCormick from Allendale in McHenry, Illinois, and Mike Zuzulo, Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Commodity Week, of course, production of Illinois Public Media. Look us up and listen to us on demand anytime you'd like on our website, willag.org. That's willag.org. You may also find us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Stitcher, NPR One app, and any other place that you would like to use us as a podcast. Now let's get a list of items we ought to discuss for the day. I think Dale Durkles, I'll start with you. What have you been watching closely?
The thing I'm trying to figure out now is what kind of ear weight do we need to be anticipating for this crop out in the field at this point?
Jim McCormick of Allendale.
Oh, what we're watching today was, demand news for the China excitement driving the beans back up, and we'll see if we can actually get a deal done.
And Mike Zuzulo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting.
Yeah, probably the biggest thing for me, Todd, in terms of giving optimism to producers right now is whether the Chinese currency crisis is right around the corner and it's sinks the boat of the emerging markets, and whether we're back into a situation like 2014, 2015, where we're talking more deflation instead of inflation. That's a hot button issue right now.
And we'll look back and forward both at the same time here. Dale Durkles, AgriVisor. Last week, USDA released its first crop production numbers. And two things jumped out at most people. One were the number of ears that were counted for population, and it was as high as it has ever been, a record at 29,200 per acre. And the second thing was that this ear weight was really quite heavy in the top three, if I remember correctly, over the last decade or so, and probably of the full time. Maybe that may not be the case, because there were some pretty good-sized ears further back you go. However, I think you've been doing some work upon ear weight. Can you tell me what you've been looking at?
Yeah, the first thing people need to understand, this ear weight that we all look and see now, a lot of people don't really understand. That's not a measured item. Everybody backs into that, including the information we get from the USDA. And what a lot of people do, they take that ear count data, which the USDA produced a number for the 10-state area. Next month, we'll get it for the individual states. But they never really produce the ear weight for the samples they collect in the field. So what happens, you take the population count against the yield that they have for any particular state or the whole 10-state area, and that's an ear weight. But the yield for any individual state also includes impact of the farmer survey. So it's not an exact measured item. A lot of people misconstrue that. But having said that, you know, the ear count number 29,250, that probably is a pretty good number, especially considering this crop's been a little bit ahead of the curve as far as progress and maturity is concerned. It may go up just a smidgen in September, but from there goes down. But the ear weight they used, 0.355 pounds, to come up with that was the third highest on record, third highest compared to the last 2 years. And when you start to understand that the last 2 years we had a bit longer period from silking through doe, through dent, and through mature, which we don't have mature still on our radar screen yet. But it looks like we're going to be ahead of the curve when we get there. In a number of days from silking, and I use the 50% mark, you could use 65, 67 if you want. But it looks like we are ahead and working with a shorter time period, which means that we got a shorter time period to fill kernels as long as this crop continues to march ahead. And that would argue that maybe they're starting out with an ear weight here at this point that's too high.
Just as a point of clarification, you said that they do not calculate ear weight on actual weights, but that's only for the August crop production report. if I remember right, the later in the year that we go, the more actual ears that they have, and they do calculate later on real ear weight. So we'll see some changes.
We the public is never privy to that ear weight data, though. They never produce the actual ear weights that they get. The only number that they ever produce is the ear count for any state where they go out and collect field sample from. And then they give us a yield number for each individual state every month. But that yield number we get on each individual state actually is a yield that includes the yield repercussions of the farmer survey. So we never get an exact ear weight that they get from the field. It's always backed into.
And then looking forward, though, your expectation is, because this crop is maturing so quickly, and it might be the upfront side of it, that growing degree days piled up so quickly early on that there is less time for grain fill to happen, and you're thinking ear weight might drop.
Right. And we got to remember, last year was an unusually long period of ear weight, too. So, and even 2 years ago was tended to be on the long side at this point. You know, and so I think we're going to be in a mix in here where we lose some calendar days to put sugars, dry matter into kernels, and we end up losing a little bit on kernel weight. Here in central Illinois, I'm already seeing a few instances and hearing some people comment that the ears on corn starting to break over. And once your ear starts to break over, you really don't have much time left. Somebody actually broke an ear and started pulling the kernels and started looking, and you could see the early beginnings of a black layer starting to develop too. And once the black layer is there, you're done, except for dry down.
So I have another question then. Did you go ahead and run some numbers on this and calculate what yields might look like at different ear weights going forward if you think it's lower?
The one I've kind of used, and you know, I've kind of just shot an arrow across the bow for this to kind of come up, but looking at 30 instead of a 0.355 pounds, thinking about something around 0.345. If I do that, then I start working at a national yield that's somewhere around 173.
So just for comparison's sake, remember USDA came out with a 178.4 in their crop production number, and they were using a much smaller number than that on the trend yield. So that 178.4 is an awfully big yield, but lower than what maybe some of the marketplace was thinking about. I'll stay with you one last question then. So if you're down that low, what does that do for ending stocks and potentially for price for corn?
Well, if you start talking about an ear weight of 0.345, if you talk about, you know, a yield at 173, you know, let's say, just to make math easy, off five bushels, and you're talking about then about 400 million off of production, and most of that I think will still come off of ending stocks, but then you start pulling your ending stocks down to, let's say, somewhere around 1.3, and that argues that, you know, as we move into the winter months, we're going to have significantly higher corn prices than what we're seeing today. If you look at the relationship between actual ending stocks or stocks to use ratio of corn and the average price paid to farmer that they're using, I could argue that the average price paid to farmer that they've got plugged in right now seems low compared to what the relationship would imply at this juncture too. So, you know, that to me argues we should be, instead of somewhere around this 360, probably up closer to $4 today.
But we're not.
Then if I take numbers down further, that goes higher. So,
well, that makes for a fairly bullish case. Let's see what everybody else has to say about this. Jim McCormick, you've been listening to Dale talk about this. I know you and the folks at Allendale often talk to producers and survey them and get a good idea of what they think this crop size looks like. What are you hearing from the field?
Well, actually, Todd, we are actually starting our annual survey that we've done 23, 24 years now. It starts next week. So we'll be getting a little bit clearer data, but actually, I agree with them. What I'm hearing, I was just actually at a Seed Corps meeting here just west of Rockford in northern Illinois just a couple days ago, and these seed guys said, we're in the field, and they said, plain and simple, fields last year that hit black layer in the middle of October to the latter part of October, they figured they're going to hit black layer at this point by the middle part of September. So they figure that you're just not going to have that time to accumulate the test weight. So I'm looking forward, just like your other guest is, for this ear weight to come down and the yields to drop. I think there's a very good shot we saw the biggest crop of the year yield-wise on last week's report for the corn.
Did they really tell you that they thought that the weight would come down? I'm surprised.
Well, I thought it would, because essentially, you know, if you look about here in Chicago last year, we had one of the longest growing seasons we ever had. We had a very late, you know, the last frost was early in the year, and we didn't have our first killing freeze till late in the year last year. So this crop just kept growing, and, you know, it had a lot of weight to it. And right now they just don't think, a lot of people around here say it's good. You're going to see smaller kernels, and that's, you know, we're going to see this crop shrink back, plain and simple. And I'm in that camp.
Mike Zuzulo, how about you?
Yeah, I'm in that camp as well, Todd. We've got 2012 drought conditions an hour away in Topeka, Kansas. And, you know, USDA saying we've got 13% of the area in drought of the Corn Belt. We had 15% last year at this time. I don't think you have any better than last year's national yield or 2015's national yield. And what early stuff I've been able to do between doing the crop tour a few weeks ago in Illinois and doing some more in Missouri and Kansas, and I'll be heading to Nebraska in about 2 weeks to do one there. But I would say full agreement with the other guys. The question is, for me, is what is the upside potential in December corn, with the idea that what pulled the corn down back in the May time period? And it was soybeans, and it was trade war, and it was currencies. And so I feel like that if you just look at a chart and don't look at anything else fundamentally, and you look at a December corn chart, if you can get back up to 392, 393 in the December corn, and close above that 200-day moving average, there's a gap at 410.5. I think that's a solid number to put orders in to get stuff hit in terms of excess bushels that you need to sell. I am fearful that number is not going to happen if we get too out of hand, though, on the currencies and we don't solve this issue with China.
Todd, the one thing that I think all of us are kind of expressing a little bit, you don't want to get farmers too bullish too soon, you know, in any of this, because I'm talking about things that are probably going to evolve and unfold, and the rest of us as well, as we go through a series of crop reports. So, you know, getting full realization of a lot of the impact of this, if we're right, probably is somewhere post-harvest. And, you know, so people have to do things and market grain accordingly in that environment, thinking that, you know, if we're going to have better prices, it's probably a long haul situation, not something that's going to happen in the next month necessarily.
All right. So I'm going to come back to you, Mike. So I need, what kind of yield number would you use?
My webinar this week to clients and subscribers on the website, I said 173 to 175. That's right with the USDA's trend line yield. I would only add to Dale's point that the USDA put in their slide the MODIS satellite vegetative index. I think that's giving us not an aberration right now, but I think that will be an aberration later because the vegetation will not be the same as last year, and they'll have to, in their anomaly, look at it versus last year and say, oh, it's drier than it was last year, exactly because of what Jim and Dale are talking about the growing season and how fast this corn is maturing. So USDA, and this goes to Dale's just previous point, is USDA is going to have to play catch up at some point. Is that going to be, and I had a client ask me this, and I think it's a fair question this week. He said, well, maybe it's not in October, November that USDA comes down because this crop's drying down so quickly. Maybe we need to be prepared for it for the September crop report. I think that's a fair assessment, and I think that's something I'm looking at, as far as if I've got someone that is literally losing bushels by the day right now, has not gotten these rains this week, and I think their corn crop and they think their corn crop's essentially done, I don't see any reason why not to start poking around on the long side for some March calls, some March 2019 calls. And at the very tightest or closest December calls.
Okay, so I need, and I think Jim McCormick, I'll come to you for this, but I want everybody to tell me a little bit of something about this, because to this point, it looks like the carry in the market is telling producers, hey, I need you to put the soybeans away, and that if you're going to market something over the scale, you might market all those corn bushels that you can't store. on the home farm. And I'm wondering first if that's what I'm reading, if I'm reading that correctly in the marketplace. And then, given this information from today, what does a producer do? Because the market has not built this kind of information in at this point, Jim.
So if I understand your question right, Todd, you're saying what do you do with the corn or the beans right now if you're a producer?
Yeah, so I want to know, what they're going to do when they're driving across the scale. They're going to have a corn crop coming out of the field early. And if the September report doesn't reflect some of what you're telling me now, the trade is saying go ahead and sell those bushels over the scale rather than paying for the commercial storage.
In general, I would tell a guy, what I have found historically, in general, you're better off. If you cannot store it physically on farm, you're probably better off just biting the bullet, move the grain to market. And then I would encourage, like I said, I think in the long run, we're going to see this rally. Use the board of trade, either buy futures or just come up with like an option strategy. You know, you can buy an at the money July corn call, a $4 corn call, pretty much for the same amount of price that an elevator would charge you to store corn out to July. So just if you can't maintain ownership, sell it and then buy a call, because I do think this corn market will rally. But I agree with the other gentleman. It may be the January report before the government comes clean and says, wow, this crop's not there. I mean, that's what we tend to find in some of these short years. It just takes a long time for it to do it. On the other hand, on the beans, I'm telling guys to be a little bit more aggressive and get rid of the beans. It's hard for me to come up with a very bullish bean story when you're looking at record U.S. carryout, record world carryout. We rallied today on optimism that the Chinese are going to come to town, but the fact is I've been telling my customers all day, they're sending the JV team. They're not even sending major delegates here, so the odds of us getting a good deal done seem slim, and when you got a carryout that could push 800 million plus, you know, $9 beans could look like a very good price down the line, unfortunately.
Okay, Mike Zuzulo, I think you gave us part of your answer for this already, but come back to me and tell me what you think producers should be doing, especially if that September report doesn't show this.
Yeah, I would just try and maybe tighten it up a little bit based upon what Jim said. I agree with wholeheartedly. I think it's important to look at where that producer is. If you've got a producer with a 70 bushel yield, and we talked about this on the closing market report last Friday, and you lose that 200-week moving average in the meal, and the meal has shown once again how strong it is as far as a leadership in this marketplace for the soy complex as a whole, even before the Chinese news came out on Thursday. But if you've got a 70-bushel field because you've got extend beans that are literally neck high, and you think you've got 70 bushels, and you're in Tolono where the bushel where the basis for fall is 40 under, that's $602 an acre. I think you really got to look at, as you said, and frame the question, excess bushels, sell them on the beans, not the corn. I just don't see the need. Now, if I'm in Atchison and I've got a 65 under fall basis and cash beans are at 835, 70 bushels on 835 is about $585. That's where it goes back to talking to the producer and saying, how much can you make on that? Is it going to be 50, 60 bucks an acre because your cost of production is lower, because your cash rents are lower? If so, I'd still let them go.
And for the corn that you can't store on the farm?
I think the corn you can't store on the farm, I'm exactly in the same mindset as Allendale with what Jim just said. It's important to realize how cheap the volatility has made re-ownership on paper. And I think you, as a producer and as a person that uses risk management and tries to elevate their risk analysis, I think it's really, really key, Todd, that producers start using more paper positions because they know where they stand, they know what they have in it, and they know what they're going to get out of it if they get to a certain price point, or they have a very good idea of what they're going to get out of it. I feel like at this stage of the game, given the situation with the crop and the situation with the trade tensions, keep it simple and keep it on paper.
You know, when I look at the two of them there, the first thing I'll say, and this is just looking at things, let's say out into spring, the spreads in beans right now are somewhere around 70, maybe 75% of full carry corn. The spreads right now are somewhere either side of, let's say, 60% of full carry. But when you look at the two structures there, and Jim pointed it out, you know, the corn structure to me is one that has better potential in it in the long haul. The beans, you know, no matter which way you cut it, and if weather cools off like it says we're going to do, if we do get rains, I mean, I can still have some pretty sporty bean yields and a big bean crop out there. Just like last year, we had a great corn crop and a mediocre bean crop, just the reverse. So I'm inclined to, you know, I get pops, I get rallies, excess beans, you know, they're probably pitched to the wolves and re-owned somehow on paper, simply because I think it's more of a bet on the come game versus the corn. You know, when you look at the yield potential and things that are going on, you look at the base fundamental structure, you know, the S&D, whether it's here or whether it's in the world, that you can see some upside opportunity. And the other thing with corn, I think once we work off into the post-harvest period, somewhere into winter, wheat export demand out of the U.S. is going to start to flourish as Russia winds down. And as Russia winds down on wheat, business coming here is probably going to give the wheat market a lift and some elevation, especially if Australian weather doesn't improve. And so I think there's better upside in corn. Now, the one thing that I think about with the carries in corn and with a tighter fundamental structure, I probably have a better chance of seeing basis levels hold up, if not get better in the long haul, than I do on beans. So I'm one, I would rather hang on to the corn, but beans, excess stuff, I think, you know, pops and rallies, get rid of it, move it out of my hands, and then look for a spot to re-own somehow on paper for a March, May, something like that.
Hey, Mike, so can you put corn in context of global coarse grain? So we have a problem in the Canadian prairies where they've been extraordinarily dry. We have a problem in the, I believe, northeast corners of Western Europe and in the southwest corner where they would have wheat and corn both. And then Russia, Ukraine have had a difficult time also this year. So I and Australia at this point, which is in its spring time frame, not looking so great. So how do you put that in that whole coarse grain complex together as it pertains to both feed grains and maybe food grains?
Yeah, and I think important in this and what you just talked about, Todd, is the idea that our world total for corn consumption in 18-19 is almost 1.1 billion tons, billion metric tons. And so the USDA has got us up very, very high, and I think rightfully so, in part because of what Dale was talking about with the wheat no longer being a feed grain. You've got a 155.5 world corn ending stocks number. I think between the countries that you just elucidated, we're probably closer to 152. We could be even down to 150, depending on how much help the recent rains help the Ukraine, and how much further rains in the next couple, 3 weeks could help the Ukraine in that area, because they're the big guy. They're the ones that have taken over the leadership role in selling to China versus the United States. They're going to displace us this year, again, for I think the third year or something like that. And USDA just made a big point about that in their updates on their world grain circulars. So again, I think mashing everything together, I'm not sure if Dale meant to commercially store corn, but I'm not ready to commercially store corn this year if the fees are as high as they were last year. You've got to give me better prices on the elevator side to commercially store corn. And I'm talking excess supplies. So I'd still, even with this kind of supply demand structure and feed grains, rather be letting the cash corn go and then on rallies before harvest and then looking to buy back on paper.
Any clarification, Dale?
I'm even kind of want to be a store of corn on a commercial basis, and there are a couple of reasons behind that. Number one, I think once we get the crop in the bin itself, I think the corn market, you know, the farmer is not going to be inclined to be an extremely willing seller. So with the demand base that we're going to have for corn here, I think that continues to put a floor underneath the market. If the wheat goes, it puts some more world demand back into the world corn market. And last but not least, this comes back from another technical perspective at this point. When I still do my counts, the low we put in corn in July was an important weekly low. And I know Zwicker had said at one point, you know, at the end of July, look, we did a monthly reversal up, which is not to be ignored. But last but not least, I think it might have been a 24 to 26 month low. So the way I see the corn market, I'm really willing to be a little bit more adventuresome with it than I am beans.
let's turn our attention elsewhere just for a moment. Jim McCormick, you wanted to talk, and we'll get to beans here, about demand out of China, the news. You've mentioned, of course, that we have a trade delegation coming to the United States and that it's a low-level delegation. This is a country that takes an awful lot of beans from across the planet. The tariffs have wreaked some havoc in the U.S. market, of course, and they have reaped some benefit in other marketplaces. What's your outlook at this time?
Well, right now, I guess I'm not super optimistic we're going to get a trade deal done anytime soon, to be quite honest. I think they want to wait and see how our fall elections go. And, you know, they will take some grain. The one thing I like to stress to people, you know, tariffs don't say they can't buy it. They just are going to pay a penalty. We're tariffing pretty much any steel imports that come into the United States, and our importers have paid, I think, a little over $1.8 billion in, or $1.4 billion in steel tariffs. So they will buy our product. But the problem is, if you look at just the current balance sheet that USDA gave us last week, they're using a demand, 50 million export demand, 50 million less than last year. Even if you raise that 100 million because you get optimism that China's going to come back in, you've still just got an immensely burdensome supply of beans right now. And what I'm really leery about right this moment is if it takes 60, 90 days to get a deal done, Todd, at the main time, you're encouraging the Brazilians to plant beans that they probably shouldn't. You've got corn stocks to use at the tightest in the world, at the tightest in 35 years. You've got a record supply of beans projected. They shouldn't be planting more beans, but they are because these tariffs have kind of given them an extra incentive to do it. There's stories out there yesterday. They're ripping up sugar fields to plant beans. So I'm just not sure if we're going to get that demand back, even if a deal is actually accomplished. So I think it's something traders need to keep an eye on. And in the long run picture, Todd, I'm worried about is, are we going to see a slingshot effect that if we have this massive amounts of beans being planted in the world and a bearish world supply, there are too many customers in the United States going to run and plant corn in the 2019 year? Because that is what I'm hearing a lot of customers of mine say is, when do I start hedging these 19 corn? Because they're very, you know, leery about locking in profits because of the bullishness for the old crop. But I personally think you could pick up 5 million more acres of corn going in next year, which could kill the corn balance sheet with a good crop next year.
Mike, let's follow up on this side of the marketplace with your issues as it relates to currency in China.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing the beans have going for them right now, Todd, is not as much the demand from China. And I'm on board with what Jim was talking about. I think the big thing is the captive supply that Argentina and Brazil are facing and their farmers are facing because of their policies and because of their weak economies. We've got a Brazilian president that signed a new freight law. It's going to keep beans at home. We've got Argentina cutting now and stopping their export tax cuts, and that's going to keep more beans at home. And the, one of their big crushing ministries or crushing industry heads said this week in Argentina that their current idle capacity right now is about 40%. They think it's going to go over 50% as far as crushing of beans for export. Look, Argentina is the number one exporter in the world by a long shot. I think USDA has them at 35% of the world exports of meal. So the more you tighten up the meal export potential in Argentina, the more the meal can lead the beans higher. But tying on and dovetailing to Jim's earlier point, Nov 19 beans closed at 934 and had a high of 938 today. If we were willing to sell new crop 18 beans at 1050 6 months ago, why wouldn't we be willing to sell 19 Nov beans close to $10 if we get there? And I think I am very nervous that the Chinese currency issue caused the Chinese to come to the table and make this meeting with the United States because their outflows were enormous. The amount that the government of China had to push into the economy in terms of infrastructure in the month of July was four times what it was in June. So I have seen in my mind and my analysis is that suggests you're a lot closer to a currency crisis in Asia and a potential financial crisis in China than we maybe thought we were before these tariffs really took the hit in China's domestic economy.
So we do have some financial problems across the planet. Turkey, of course, has got a problem. Mike's suggesting that there could be a problem in the Chinese currency. Does this worry you very much at all, Dale?
It really does a little bit, you know, and it kind of dovetails in. You know, I watch some long-term price cycles. Mike, I think, does too. You know, I took a look at some commodity indices here. Oh, it was last week or over the weekend, and trying to, again, stay in step with how the long-term picture was unfolding. And we really muddied the count up a little bit in the late 90s, but trying to stay in step with where we are, I'm really starting to swing to the opinion that the low we had in commodity indices back at the beginning of 16 was probably a three-year low. Could have even been a nine-year low, and basically says, you know, somewhere here in early 19, we got another three-year low coming along in commodity prices to some level. Now, it doesn't say anything about any individual commodity, but that just looks at things in a broad aggregate and doesn't say anything about what level. But it does speak to what he's talking about there with a potential currency crisis in Asia, and harkens back to the one we had, this would be back in late 2000, somewhere in there. I don't remember the exact time of it, when we had a lot of problems in Japan. And we can run into another situation like that, you know, and they tend not to necessarily, they don't necessarily have to be long lasting, but they do have pretty harsh impacts for over a course of a number of months when they do occur. And I think something like beans, it's starting to see a padding of your fundamental structure, probably is the one market that may succumb to some of that pressure as much as anything else. And, you know, we won't even get into the weakness of the political structure in the key South American countries.
That took place, by the way, just after Freedom to Farm put in place in 95-96.
Yeah.
We were talking a lot about the Asian, what we call the Asian tigers at that point, and they just failed to develop early on. And China would have been in that list, and it failed, and then we ended up with, the 2002 Farm Bill after the fact. So those are some of the things historically that we're talking about. Let's begin to wrap this up. I think I'll get a final word from each of you. Mike Zuzulo from Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. Let's start with you, please.
I think the key for the next couple of weeks is those rallies on value level selling is important, starting with beans. I think Larry Kudlow said it on CNBC very plainly, very bluntly today, or I should say on Thursday, where he talked about, I'm not here to pilot the dollar, but we want it steady. But we love the fact that the world is confident in the U.S. dollar. So we have kind of interjected our trade policy, our currency policy, and our foreign policy together. We've got to play the markets that way, if you ask me.
Jim McCormick of Allendale, your final word?
My final word is prepare for a little bit of volatility, I think, coming in here. We've got the crop reports coming in, and we're going to see if the crop is smaller than a lot of us agreed it was going to be a little bit smaller. And I think farmers need to take advantage of opportunities. I mean, the best thing I can give people is look what happened last night. Everyone was kind of quietly watching, you know, watching baseball or something. All of a sudden the bean market exploded because of, China's coming to town. Be prepared for volatility. I tell customers, you know, if you got bushels to sell, get those open orders working. You never know when this market may move, because there'll be a lot of political stuff coming at us between now and the election time, I believe.
And Dale Durkles is with AgriVisor.
Well, I think it's important, and it was mentioned earlier, that, you know, any agreement or any change in this relationship with China is probably going to be slow to develop, and it really isn't about tariffs, that it's about intellectual property and economic impediment for companies outside of China to invest in and operate within China itself, and that's going to be a long time coming. So a China agreement's probably not going to get done right away. I think Mike's comment about where it lines up to the elections pretty well on the mark at this juncture. I do think, though, when you look at the three grains that we deal with here, that the wheat and corn probably have a bit better road ahead than do soybeans. So if I'm going to hook my team to any wagon, it's probably going to be into one of those two, either the wheat or the corn, and think that we got some better prices coming with the beans. I'm going to play it more cautiously, more carefully.
Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. Listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. Our panelists this week have included Dale Durkles of AgriVisor out of Bloomington, Illinois, Jim McCormick from Allendale, he's in McHenry, Illinois, and Mike Zuzulo at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.